steps to restore an ecosystem, to make sure it not only looks like it used to, but that it sounds right too. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael thanks Trump for giving almost everyone something to fight for.
Trump's so impressive, clearing away hypocrisy and inefficiency on his first day. The January 6th Capitol tourists have been pardoned, and the federal investigation of them no longer exists. The Constitution says if you were born here, you're a citizen, but the founders didn't mean that if your parents weren't citizens. The U.S. is withdrawing from the World Health Organization. Why should a rich country that doesn't provide government health insurance pretend to care about its citizens' health? Likewise, if we're going to drill, baby, drill, and a warming earth is a hoax, why does the Paris Climate Agreement exist? At least we might not have a new war soon, as the military will be busy at the border. No new hires for federal government, especially the IRS, but why hire new people if Musk's going to lay off tens of thousands who are already working? All our money will soon say, in crypto we trust. If you need more truth, go to Facebook, X, Fox News, The Washington Post, or TikTok. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 22nd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Dave Johnson, Dan Raphael, and Anna Wilcox. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Luna Winchester. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Sam Becker from Street Roots to talk about their latest article. It's called Legislator Introduces Campus Security Reforms Following Street Roots Reporting. House Bill 2551 expands background checks, doesn't close oversight loophole. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thanks, Althea. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, excited to have you with us. So your new article details Oregon House Bill 2551, which seeks to change how public universities hire campus security officers. And this bill is based in part on past Street Roots reporting. As a primer, let's start there. What did past reporting uncover?
That's a great question. So in June of 2024, I wrote a story titled Banned Ex-Cops Patrol Oregon University Campuses for Street Roots. I found that a legal loophole was allowing ex-cops with a lifetime ban from law enforcement to search, cite, and arrest people on and around university campuses. The story was really kicked off by some legal records I obtained from Oregon's Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, or DPSST. I found that in 2016, a then law enforcement officer with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, he was patrolling the Jackson County Fair, He alleged that he encountered someone who was a minor with alcohol. The minor then proceeded to refuse an ID check and run into the crowd. The law enforcement officer then chased, tackled, and put into a headlock this person. Then he proceeded to lie about it to his superior. So he was left with, he was fired from OLCC for his violent actions and for his dishonesty. And then he was left with a lifetime ban from law enforcement in Oregon. Less than 2 years later, he was hired as a campus safety officer at Southern Oregon University, where he still works today. His name is Matthew Roberts, and the records that I obtained to kind of demonstrate this are available through that first story.
So how would House Bill 2551 change things?
Yeah, as you mentioned, this bill would require Oregon's public universities to request and review disciplinary records from DPSST for campus security applicants. The text also allows universities to use this information in hiring decisions. And so I think it's important to note that right now, the community colleges and private colleges in Oregon have to hire candidates that are vetted, trained, certified, and disciplined by DPSST. So there's all of this oversight happening. And meanwhile, the special campus security officers at Oregon University, special campus security officers are a type of security officer that are unique to Oregon's public universities. They're not subject to any of this oversight. And so the sort of rationale with House Bill 2551 is that with these DPSST records in hand, universities may have decided against hiring ex-law enforcement officers with a lifetime ban from public safety work from DPSST. So for example, SOU may have avoided hiring someone like Matthew Roberts if they had these records in hand. However, it's the case that right now, there's nothing that actually prevents universities from still hiring someone who may have been given a lifetime ban from DPSST.
Just to be super duper clear about the Department of Public Safety standards, training, or DPSST, as you mentioned, what is the normal course of action that that body takes when officers are being disciplined?
Let's say an officer, a law enforcement officer, engages in a variety of actions, including or such as abuse, sexual misconduct, hate crimes, or dishonesty. They would be left with a lifetime ban from law enforcement. That would be handed down by DPSST. The same actions would only result in a 4-year ban for a security officer regulated by DPSST. So think a security officer at a private college or a community college. And these actions would also prevent an aspiring security officer from obtaining a security license for 4 years. And as I mentioned earlier, special campus securities don't fall into either category. They're exempt from any centralized state oversight, despite being the fact that they're directly hired by a state university. And they actually have these law enforcement powers and immunities that are unique to special campus security officers. These aren't powers and immunities that have that security officers at community colleges and private colleges have. You know, it's important to note that the lack of oversight means DPSST could enact a lifetime ban on a fired former law enforcement officer one day, and a university could hire them the next day as a special campus security officer with arrest and citation authority. So while HB 2551 does require these DPSST records to be examined, obtained and examined by universities, again, there's nothing actually requiring a university to be held to any minimum standard, right? I think the idea of a minimum standard is one that makes a lot of sense to people. Students, legal experts, legislators I spoke with for the initial investigation were all, I think, quite surprised by the fact that there's no minimum bar required for these special campus security officers.
From your research, was there a reason that public universities compared to community colleges and private ones, why were they left out of this?
So the loophole, from what I have been able to understand, is an indirect result of a 2015 law that changed university governance structure. This law basically gave universities the power to operate as sort of individual entities, although they're still working together through the Higher Education Coordinating Committee. But with that said, no one I've spoken with for this story knows whether the decision to exempt special campus security officers from DPSSP oversight was actually intentional. And I think it's also important to note that there's nothing preventing the state, this legislation, for example, from requiring these special campus security officers to be regulated by DPSSP once again.
Well, this bill, House Bill 2551, is supported by Southern Oregon University, SOU, like you mentioned, and Portland State, but not everyone is happy with it. Who are they, and what are some of their criticisms?
Yeah, so again, I spoke with a number of folks for the initial story, but for this most recent story, I can talk about someone I interviewed, Arthur, who is a junior SOU active in LGBTQIA2S+ organizing on campus. He said that he's really glad attention is being brought to this issue, but that he's concerned that nothing in the bill prohibits universities from hiring ex-law enforcement officers with a lifetime ban from law enforcement. And so I also spoke with the student body president at SOU, and she mentioned that she thinks students should have a say in how the bill looks. And she herself suggested having maybe some sort of a hiring committee where maybe students, staff across the university would be able to come together to consider whether people who have quote-unquote uncomfortable circumstances from their past jobs should be hired as a special campus security candidate. So, you know, it seems like students that I interviewed for this story have thoughts about how this bill can be improved. But I think it's important to note that when I spoke with Representative Zach Hudson about who he contacted when writing this bill, it was notable that he didn't reach out to any students. I think that's even more of note because in the story I wrote, examining this issue and really breaking down this loophole for the first time, it was clear that students were concerned about this issue.
What would you say are the key takeaways that you hope folks get from this story?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very much the case that the people that I've spoken with for this story, I think, are concerned about student safety, whether that's the representatives, the students, the legal experts, you know, people all sort of want to make sure that students are going to be safe on campus. And I think right now the legislators have an opportunity to address a loophole that, you know, we identified over the summer and ensure that they do so in a way that really does make sure that student safety is being centered. I think, you know, closing with the words of Arthur here, Arthur said that security officers at universities, community colleges, or private colleges, they should all be held to the same standard because the thought of having someone who has a history of violence or dishonesty in a position of power over him or anybody else in the student body was terrifying.
If our listeners are interested in finding out more, reading your story for themselves, what's the best way to do that?
So you should be able to read the story in print by picking it up if you're in the Portland metro area. You know, people are going to be selling it. It should be in some newspaper stands, and then, of course, you can access it digitally over the next few days. It should be available on the Street Roots website.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I think that's a good place to end it. Yeah, thanks so much, Althea.
Thank you, Sam. I appreciate you taking the time. That was Sam Becker from Street Roots speaking with me about their latest article. It's called Legislator Introduces Campus Security Reforms Following Street Roots Reporting. House Bill 2551 expands background checks, doesn't close oversight loophole. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
This is Dr. Demento, and you are listening to the KBOO News, the only news you need.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Melissa Melko from Rewild Portland to talk about the upcoming annual North American Rewilding Conference from January 24th through the 26th at the Bridge Space Commons in Portland. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So for folks who aren't familiar with this event, what is the annual North American Rewilding Conference?
This is a time of year during this kind of slow winter introspection season that we get people together, individuals, groups, grassroots organizations, all people who are working to restore ecosystems and importantly, humans' place in them, and people who see humans as kind of woven in and connected part of nature, not separate from it, and talk about human history, what's happening in the environment right now, and kind of what all we can do about it together.
What does rewilding mean exactly?
Well, my favorite definition of it is living in community with your ecological place, kind of the idea of, like, regardless of where we come from, our ancestors come from, like, wherever we're living now, like, how can we be good stewards there? And how can we, like, reconnect to the wildness, the autonomy in ourselves and in our communities in a good way?
Well, the theme of this year's conference is subsistence and resistance. What can you tell me about that theme? Like, why was it chosen?
Subsistence as resistance has become our kind of perennial theme, and it is about trying to reclaim autonomy in our communities and see, you know, outside of the, you know, destructive forces of consumerism and capitalism, like, how can we work together to meet the needs of people and in our communities with all of the resources and skills and imagination that we have, like, right where we are.
What does that look like in the past, in years past, for this conference, this reclaiming of autonomy?
Well, we have had so many amazing speakers come over the years. And the cool thing about the conference is that we invite a lot of people who are thinking about these topics, and then the conference kind of creates itself. So it's not just about sitting and listening to experts speak. We do have speakers, and we do have... you know, usually some forums that kind of set the tone and get everybody on the same page around, like, being cultural ambassadors and, like, agreements. And we then have an open space, which is basically a conference that's created out of people's questions and curiosity. And it's a really cool technology where we kind of listen to some of the speakers that we've invited on different topics that could have to do with anything from, like, homesteading to wildlands restoration to, you know, seed saving, or some of the more, like, philosophical and theoretical parts of rewilding. And then we kind of have all of our questions on a board and get together in groups with people who are, you know, have the same curiosities and want to share about the same kind of things. And then the conference, like, creates itself. And it's pretty magical.
That's cool. I got to imagine it's good for the planning side of things, too, to not have to totally prescribe it.
Yeah. It's like kind of meets whatever people's needs that they come to the conference with. Hopefully they can, you know, create conditions to, like, get what they want out of it.
Well, with that, what are some of the activities and speakers that folks will find at this year's event?
So this year we have some amazing folks coming on Friday the 24th for the teaching day. Peter Michael Bauer, Rewild Portland instructor, is going to be talking and kicking things off. And then we have Mark Lakeman, who's the founder of City Repair, Lee from Shared Spaces Foundation, Andrew Sage is going to talk about reimagining the future of urban life, and Jennifer Rosemary Sarah is from Wapato Island Farms is going to be talking about connecting with our more than human kin and ancestral land tending and medicine making, and then finally Rain Crow from the Village Mystery School is going to be talking about animism, ancestral council way, which is kind of like transformational conflict resolution. So we're addressing like the, you know, ecology side of things, the human relations side of things, and then we can kind of, you know, ruminate on all of that overnight, and then Saturday it's open space. Mm-hmm. Part of the conference, and then on Sunday we're going to have land tending at three different locations where people can put some of the ideas into action and do some stewardship activities together.
I'm curious, with this sort of format, are there favorite conversations or things that have been sparked in years past in this conference that come to mind for you?
Yeah, there's been so many connections made over the years and so much inspiration. I am a parent, and I have sat in on some conversations around parenting and education and family and kind of rewilding the home that have been really awesome, had a lot of really great takeaways. And I also work in land stewardship planning, and I have met some amazing people who are doing land back work and have been connected with people who are doing seed ecology work and thinking about how do we, you know, tend land in the era of wildfires and, you know, water shortages and thinking about preparedness and on a community kind of neighborhood network. Those have all been really impactful for me, and I know other people have had like all kinds of different takeaways, and there's a lot of variety.
Mm-hmm. Who is this conference for? Who should come?
This conference, you know, over the past years, there have been folks from all walks of life, students, parents, farmers, gardeners, and tech folks who are, you know, feeling the stress of their jobs and are like, I want to reconnect with myself, I want to reconnect with nature. Really people from like lots of different fields of study and exploration and different paths. So it's a pretty diverse group. But I think one thing people have in common who are interested is that, you know, they are feeling like a disconnection from nature or self or community, and they want more connection and a feeling of a sense of wholeness in their life.
What do you hope that folks who do come and attend, what do you hope they get out of the event?
Well, one of the things I'm most excited about that I think is going to be really impactful for people is our keynote speaker on Sunday afternoon, Rowan White, who's an Indigenous seed keeper, is going to be talking about her experience with food sovereignty, and I think it's going to be wonderful to hear from her. We really try to learn from Indigenous land stewards and traditional ecological knowledge, and I think that she's going to wrap the conference up in a really good way, so I'm excited about that.
In doing this kind of work, do you encounter misconceptions that people might have about the idea of rewilding or why it's important?
Yeah, there's so many misconceptions. And Peter Michael Bauer has a podcast, the Rewilding Podcast, and I think the latest episode was about myths about rewilding. So people could check that out. But I think there's a lot of ideas that it might be about. There's a movement called conservation rewilding, or just like the environmental conservation movement that thinks that land and nature is better without human intervention, and that we should like leave it alone, kind of fence it off and walk away. And that's a very, very different philosophy than the cultural rewilding movement that believes that humans aren't inherently bad in ecology. We have a place, but we need to find a balanced place, and looking at traditional cultures we can understand better, and looking at earlier human history, the hunter and gatherer era, we can understand more about like what that balanced relationship looks like. What does reciprocity look like?
And yet urbanism still fits into that somewhere?
Yeah, we have to work with what we have, where we are at with our communities. So we can't all just go back to being hunter-gatherers now, but we can think about how to get more of our needs met in our communities and in more ecological ways, and be good stewards.
If our listeners are interested, where can they find out more about the event?
Rewilding.com is where all the details and registration are.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't get to mention?
I think that if there's folks out there who are feeling really anxious about the state of the world or thinking about, the environment and feeling worried and want to connect with other people who have, maybe a lot of the same feelings and want to connect and look for practical solutions and collaborative solutions to some of these really complex problems that we are up against, like this is a really good place, a really inclusive and warm and a safe place to feel that anxiety and also feel hopeful.
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Melissa Melko from Rewild Portland speaking with me about the upcoming annual North American Rewilding Conference. It'll be held January 24th, 25th, and 26th at Bridge Space Commons PDX. The address is 133 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information is online at rewilding.com. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billing.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
My name is Raleigh, and you are tuned in to The Underground on KBOO Portland, a public affairs program created by, for, and about youth.